Hello and welcome to the October edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor, and later on I'll be joined by my colleagues from Garden Organic, Chris Collins and Dr. Anton Rosenfeld. Well, September was full of surprises, with the middle of the month bringing some very early frosts for us here in the Midlands. But we loved welcoming our wonderful Garden Organic members to Wrighton for a special Members' Day. Now, autumn is well and truly underway. The trees are turning a beautiful golden brown and leaves are falling, ready for us to start making leaf mould. And later on, we'll be answering your questions on that, as well as troublesome tomatoes. This month, we chat again with our friend Sally Morgan, all about how to make your garden more resilient to meet the challenges of our changing climate. But before we start, I'd just like to thank our sponsors, Viridian Nutrition. Viridian produce a range of award-winning ethical and organic supplements, which include vitamins, minerals, herbal oils and balms. I love the way they call themselves the vitamin company with an organic heart. Their supplements are stocked in over 1,000 specialist health stores across the UK. So to find out more, visit viridiannutrition.com. That's viridian-nutrition.com. And now I'm off to join Chris in the potting shed. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm very good, Fiona. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Always lovely to see you.
And you?
Well, we've had a lovely walk round this morning, haven't we? We're here at Wrighton Organic Gardens, the Garden Organic HQ, and we went up to see the Heritage Seed Library, and just all very inspiring this morning, wasn't it?
Yes, there's a lot going on, isn't there? There's a lot of the HSL department are busy people this time.
Getting ready for the seed list.
Yeah, they earn their coin, I think.
They really do. if anybody listening isn't a member of the Heritage Seed Library, then I do urge you to have a look into it. Just go to our website, Garden Organic, and you will find all sorts of information about the Heritage Seed Library, because it's completely unique.
It is, and I think what's important to say about it, for my, you know, as a grower, the taste of those crops are much better than an F1 or a bread or a highly bred tomato or a highly bred bit of kale. The seeds here produce some wonderfully tasting plants.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a seed conservation program, for those who don't know. We've got over 800 varieties of UK veg. They're heritage and heirloom. You can't get them anywhere else because they're not on the commercial listing, which means that they don't get sold in garden centres or in other places where you buy seeds. So it's really unique. And these are seeds that have been passed down through generations.
Well, it's interesting there because at Lawrence Hills, if you looked at a picture of him, looks quite an unassuming guy, I would say. You know, it was a genius, really, because when we joined the EU, they insisted that we registered all our seeds. And what would have happened then was a lot of seeds that were passed on the heirlooms or gardener to gardener would have been lost because you'd have to register and it was very expensive. So he then put an advert in the Times and said, send us your heirloom seeds, send us your seeds. And that saved a lot of things, a lot of varieties we wouldn't have now. So not only did he set this up, but he had that incredible foresight. And I think that's what gardeners have, that ability to look into the future almost.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, seed saving is such a joy, isn't it? You know, if you've grown something and you've really enjoyed it, and you save the seed and give it to somebody else, you know, that means they can grow it, they can enjoy it.
I think that's the spirit of gardening. I think that's the spirit of it. I really do. I was lucky enough, actually, I got given a pumpkin by my neighbour on the allotment a couple of weeks ago, and it was amazing. I had it with pasta and a bit of cinnamon.
Lovely.
It was unbelievable. But, of course, that pumpkin is for that site, and it's the guy who gave it to me has been growing it for 30 years. So, obviously, every seed I got out of the pumpkin before I cooked it has now been dried off and is in store for next year. Yeah. And then what a nice touch, because I've got a nice memory of him giving me that gift.
Yes.
And then next year when I grow it, it'll recall that, you know, and the pumpkin cracks on.
It's amazing, isn't it? And because it was grown on an allotment next to yours, you know it's going to succeed on your allotment.
Yeah, exactly, because it's a regional, it's climatically suited to that vicinity.
So exactly. The seed has adapted perfectly.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. We talked last time a bit about you and I both kind of thinking, wouldn't it be nice to save some seed from local parks and things like that? You know, if you're in a park and there's seed heads there
And you said you've been doing a bit of seed rambling.
Yes.
Have you sown any of yours?
I have sown quite a few of them. Yes. I've got about 200 hollyhocks.
Yes.
They'll go and moved out, so I'll take them some to the lot, and some will go to clients. I've got one propagator. I've just called it Lucky because I collected a load of stuff and I don't know what it is, so I put it in. And it's all germinated. It looks like my loving a mist, and I think there's a few other bits of them, but I just call it my Lucky Pot. Yeah. I quite like it. It's like past the parcel when you were a kid. You don't quite sure what you're going to get. Obviously, I'm quite... Oh, yeah, my seed sale hasn't let up, really.
No, well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, here we are in October, and actually there are still seeds to sow. And, you know, particularly thinking about food crops and what we're going to grow to eat. So we'd always talk a lot about winter crops and, you know, perhaps what you can still sow outside. And, I mean, you know, what would you still give a go outside? We'll come inside in a minute. But if you wanted to still just give it a bit of a shot in the last closing sort of...
The final bits. Yeah, certainly salad bar, micro greens I would still go for. A spinach could germinate quite late. If it doesn't get up, you've got to remember, if you're sowing stuff and it germinates, it might not grow into a big plant, but you're just going to eat it as a microgreen, really. So I've got two operations going on. I've got a big trough in my polytunnel on my allotment, and I'll salad bar that. So I'll just sow spinach. Or like chard is amazing as a seed. Radish as a seedling is really nice as well. So come again, the salads, rocket will still go. So I tend to sow those, but I intersow as well to keep them rolling on. So that certainly, I'm grazing the allotment all winter. I'll graze parsnips I've got on there. I've got Christmas potatoes in. I've got lots of kale and broccoli under netting. I'll just graze that as well. Turnips, swedes, I'll graze. So that's going on. But then on top of that, I'll microgreen. I'll sow those short-term crops. And if they don't get up too big because it's the wrong time of year, I mean, I'm promising a radish seedling or chard seedling or rocket seedling straight into a sandwich. It's just amazing.
It's delicious. Yeah, so don't worry too much. If it doesn't get too big, don't worry. Still
just crop them as a microgreen. And I do that indoors as well. I will get four sort of old mushroom pallets and then get like a barbecue, old barbecue tray as a drip tray. I'll sow four of those. I'll use my peat-free compost. I'll sow them like any seed. I'll fill the pallet up to a centimetre from the top. I'll broadcast the seed on it, make sure it's nice and thick. Cover them over, give it a tamp. And then what I'll do is I'll let that grow for 2 weeks, but then I'll sow another four off. Mm-hmm. So I can then rotate them over, and that pretty much gives me... I mean, apart from December, January, February, well, even then I'll still do some. I'll keep cropping, yeah.
All right, so on the indoor kind of salad bar situation, the micro salad bar, what are we talking about there, sort of, you know?
Yep, certainly spinach. Pea shoot is obviously a favourite. And they can't come again. You'll get 3-4 goes out.
Yep.
They're pretty determined, you know, they really are. Spinach is very good in there. I definitely like spinach. Again, the usual chard, radish, cut and come salad, all those sort of quick crop, what I call quick crop salad crops, all go in there,
Yeah, okay.
Mustard is another good one as well. I love a mustard.
Yeah.
Sort of peppery mustard, you know, an Indian mustard, something like that.
Yeah. I just say it's just great to be able to just take these things yourself and put them straight into your sandwich. And, you know, it's just fantastic, isn't it? I mean, on the herb side of things, you know, I never bother harvesting rosemary and bay and drying it because it goes right through the winter. So, you know, you might as well just take it when you need it. But for other ones, I have been hanging up and drying. So thyme and oregano and marjoram, absolutely brilliant. So satisfying because they dry terribly easy. I actually don't hang them up. I lay them out on a newspaper, and you know, within a few days they're dry enough, and then they're just really easy to just strip off the stems and then put into a glass jar. I think the thing about drying herbs is it's a bit of a risky business. You know, sometimes you can't get them completely dry. Have you ever had that?
Well, I like to hang mine. Yeah. Your technique sounds better because you do. I think you can lose judgment on them. You can lose time. You know, well, you put them out now, they must be dry now. And, and also, I think obviously because you put them in bunches, then obviously stuff on the inside is going to stay moist, isn't it?
That's the problem.
So you prefer to spread them out on paper so you can see what's going on. And then you obviously means you can turn them as well.
Yeah,
and stuff
that's
like
right.
That.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you just get, well, I'm presuming they'll just go moldy if you ever.
Well, that's the awful thing when that does happen, because if you've made the plans and you've gone to all the effort, you know, to harvest and everything, and then you put them in your glass jar and then you suddenly see it going mouldy and you've lost a whole lot, you know, definitely worth drying them out. I mean, there's various tricks around. Like somebody was telling me earlier about using your air fryer. So, you know, if you've got one of those sort of internal grills within the air fryer, you just put the herbs underneath that grill so they don't all fly about. And you switch it. So that, you know, I mean, some people talk about drying things off in the microwave. I've not done that. Maybe I should have a go. But
what if it decreases the flavour if you microwave it? Do you think that'd be an issue?
I think it's a very short time that you would need to microwave it. But I mean, the thing about herbs is they're so giving because you can get loads off one small plant, and it's plenty. It's absolutely plenty. Yeah. You know, if you think of those herb pots that you can buy in the supermarket, that's not a lot of herb in there. It's not difficult.
Yeah, so exactly. So reduce that. And you really are spending a quid a time on those packets.
Yes.
Fresh stock. I mean, the packet of seeds, like basil, you buy a packet of basil seeds, they'll have 100, 150 seeds in it.
Yeah.
That's a lot of basil.
The wonderful thing about freezing herbs is, I mean, there's lots of tricks. You know, people talk about, you know, putting butter and oil into ice cube trays, and then you put your herbs in that. Great idea. But you can just freeze dry some of them. So, for example, chives. If you harvest a whole head of chives, you know, there's going to be hundreds, and then you snip them down, and then they don't stick together in the freezer.
Yeah.
So you can just take a little pinch of them whenever you need them. And
it's a good idea. Very good idea.
It's all good for the soul, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you're cooking in the dead of winter, and you're adding herbs that you've grown yourself. So yeah, I'm a big fan. I have to say it's good for the soul, definitely. What are you going to harvest through the winter?
The stuff I've put in already, a lot of stuff will sit in the ground. Okay, like my parsnips, I don't lift those. I'll take them as I need.
Yes.
Obviously, my potatoes, I've got quite a lot of potatoes in the ground. I've added some more for Christmas, but I've no problem with that. If I do leave them a bit too long, I think in January, February, I'll get stuff with earworm and stuff in there, so I have to be a bit careful.
Do you store them? Are they storing
properly? Yeah, I'll try and store them in my sandy box. Obviously, kale and broccoli, I've planted so much of that, I'll probably look like kale or broccoli come the spring. So there's a bit of that. And I've got things like Savoy cabbage, white cabbage. They're all sitting there. They've really started to fill out now. And I don't see any reason why I need to take them off. I will graze them out of the ground. I think brassicas as well, if you get a good frost on them, they taste so much better. The taste of them improves dramatically in colder weather. I like to sit them out in the air. So they're things I've got. I've got leeks I can graze as well.
Yeah.
So there's just bits and bobs I can do along on through the winter. And that's about making sure I've sown them earlier on in the year, like late summer, earlier on in the year, so I can run right through with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew a whole load of leeks this year in a large pot. It's looking good, I have to say. It really is looking good. I mean, I've probably got about 70 leeks.
Lovely.
And the problem I had last year was I grew them in the ground and they got really badly trampled. And I think it was probably the local foxes.
Yeah.
And I really was so disappointed. But actually, the problem is, especially with food growing, if you're not thinking about it now, then you're going to fall behind. So what do we need to be thinking about now in October?
Well, certainly, I'm going to carry on doing what I'm doing. I'm going to graze what I've already put in, and then I'm going to do my microgreens. But then I'll start, you know, come March, I'll be starting to sow again. I'll be off out of the traps again, really.
Yeah.
I think it's to stagger sow is the art. So I never really stop sowing. I sow right through the growing season. Because otherwise what happens is you sow everything in spring and you've got this massive bounty in July, August, and then there's big holes everywhere. So it's kind of trying to think of making sure you're continually using your space is quite important. And then the space I'm not using on the allotment now that hasn't got swede or turnip in or cabbage, I'll put it down with green manure. That's all come up. So that nothing's really bare, really. I'll kind of keep things going as much as I can.
And if, like, you know, somebody's sitting not a million miles from you right now, you didn't get around to your green manure in time, what would you do instead?
Well, if you've got leaf mould or compost, you can put some cardboard down and cover it in that. That's probably a good alternative, yeah.
So just protect the soil.
Yeah, just to stop it leaching, it getting, you know. Otherwise, the rain hits it, you ruin the structure of it, and all the nutrient, more importantly, all the nutrient will be washed through into the subsoil.
Yeah, not good. Okay, so let's talk about fruit then. I know you're doing some work with an orchard.
It's an old orchard and it's been let go, so I've got a lot of work to do over the winter on it. But things like apples and pears, I had some amazing pears out there last week. They're just coming to the end now, but I'll leave the actual pruning until late winter. There's a big rule, I think, when you are pruning. Obviously, you do spur pruning, but just generally, just make sure you cut out any crossing or rubbing wood or any tangled wood. That's quite a good way place to start, I think. But obviously, I've got all the soft fruit, which was quite... It's been a good year for soft fruit. A lot of people have been very successful. But the soft fruit there, it's got quite old and leggy. So there's a lot of fruit on it, but it's all on the top because it's all produced on the current season's growth.
Yeah.
So it's like the growth that's put on over the summer. So I'll get in there and anything that looks over 2 years old in wood terms, any currant or berry, I will probably prune out all of that old wood.
Okay.
Pick some nice, strong, young shoots, leave them be, but mostly stall it and get them to shoot again so I can get a good crop for next year.
Okay, so you don't take it all down.
Some people might stall completely, but I like to, if there's some nice, good shoots on there, I'll probably retain them. I just check. I do that as I find the plant. Really.
Yeah.
I just want to get rid of all that old wood, anything tangled or old, getting a bit tired. Yeah. All that will go, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I follow your principle that you told me last month about dead, diseased and dying.
Yes.
I have done that throughout the month. And I had a really good blitz with my houseplants. I went right through them all. And then I gave them a bit of feed from my my wormery. And they have just come back.
Yeah, a little bit of love and affection. Yeah. You'll see.
Yeah.
I think also you've got to remember with plants, and this applies to all plants, with fruit or shrubs or whatever, is they need to breathe, just like we need to breathe. They exchange chemicals from the atmosphere and gases from the atmosphere. So you don't want it a big tangled mess. You want to be able to cut out any dead wood, cut out any crossing, rubbing wood, let the air pass through the plant, and it'll be much happier for it.
So what about apples and pears and those kind of...
Yeah, late fruit? Winter for me. I'll spur them late winter. Okay. Yeah. So about February, late February, I'll get in there with the sack tears and I'll spur them all back. All the new growth, I'll spur back to two buds, basically.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've got a fig tree. What should I be doing?
Well, figs are quite tough. I would take any old wood I'll take out as well. But you can shape that, you know. You can. I've cut them right down to the ground and they'll come again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, any, open the plant out. Make sure the plant's nice and open and they're heating the sun and getting to them.
Smaller than your thumbnail. Take them off.
Yeah, so that's right. So you've got a framework, like a grape, you're pulling into a framework. Also, another good tip is when you get the nodes, the growing points on the stems, always prune to the one that's facing outwards, not inwards, and then you'll keep the plant open as well.
Yeah. Okay, now that is a really good tip. Yeah, thank you. What about soft fruit in terms of strawberries?
Yeah, you could give them a good... I think they benefit from a really strong haircut.
Okay.
You can do that now if you wanted, any time of
week. Take them right back down.
Absolutely hit them hard, And then you just get that lovely new growth the following year.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they become sort of full of dead leaf and leggy and they kind of messy, I think. But they'll take a decent haircut.
Okay. Really good. My goodness, lots of good advice. And it's good to think about food and what we can grow next year and, you know, and how to look after those perennial plants that just give us so much each year. Any other priorities? Priorities that we need to be thinking about?
Yeah, well, allotment's fine. Like I say, I'm sitting pretty. It's been an interesting year because everything was so late.
Yes.
So I've been cropping really heavily off it through August and September, really.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of coming to the end of that now.
I'm amazed that you got away with that.
It was nothing on there in June, late June.
I know. It's amazing.
Well, my salad crops were incredible. Once I got... I had a real problem getting past the slugs, I think, like most people did. So I've had no courgettes this year. My first year ever, I've had no courgettes.
No, same as me.
Because they were just eating them off.
Yeah.
But actually, the late summer, it's kind of played in my favour because they've been less active and I've just got... And I'm taking some wonderful salad stuff off there. So that's been really good. I mean, there's stuff that'll just sit in the ground, as we discussed. So I kind of feel that. So I've got my hardy annuals I sow and stuff, or my seed clip that I sow in my propagators at home. And that when they get a certain size, they'll go into my polytunnel, into seed... onto seed trays. So that's all ticking over nice. The balcony is an interesting one because what happens with that, it's very easy to sort of go, well, I'll put the bulbs in. That's that done. Everything's ready for spring. I'm going to be sitting out there having a glass of wine in the evening. It's going to be too cold. So it's very easy to sort of forget about it. So I try to get around that. I like to plant it up. I like to think a bit differently. I like using dogwoods, like the brightly coloured dogwood stem. Bright red, bright yellow. They strike really easily from hardwood canes you can take in the winter. Use those in a few pots and underplant with some pansies. You get really nice and bright colour. You can use plants like sarcococca or daphne, which are really scented.
Gorgeous scent.
Beautiful scented. So don't dislocate from your balcony. It's very easy to become dislocated for it. You leave it in November and you come back out in March and then you haven't used it. So I think you've got to put a few pots out there that keep you engaged.
Yes. Keep you in touch with it.
Yeah.
You know, what's it feeling like out there? What's it smelling like?
Exactly. So, and remember, bird life will need it. So you put your bird food up as well. It's still a really good place to go out and be active. And I think I love those crispy sort of winter days when the sun comes up and it's not cloudy and you go and stand out there then. The bird life is singing and, you know, that's a special time. I think it's a season in its own right, you know, it really is.
Absolutely. So we shouldn't just sit behind closed doors. Just make sure we still... Yeah, get our hands in the soil.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Cheers, Fiona.
This month, Sally Morgan joins us to chat about her latest book, The Resilient Garden and Allotment Handbook, which looks at ways of future-proofing our gardens and allotments. Sally talks us through why it's important to have diverse planting and how to adapt to unpredictable conditions in your garden.
So, Sally, tell us where it all began. I mean, when did you start to really think hard about gardening, about plants, about growing. Where did your interest spark from?
I was very lucky. I have had houses, lived in houses surrounded by gardeners who love to talk to young children and encourage them to grow things. So I was always a gardener from a very young age with grandparents who insisted to eat things like spinach. And
yes,
I was lucky. I grew up in London with a lovely big garden full of wildlife. So my interest was sparked even at school. I knew it was going to be a career in wildlife, conservation, ecology, something like that. So I went up to Cambridge and did part two in botany, where I was totally enthused by some real people of their time, Harry Hudson, you know, a mycologist, and other leading experts who really enthused me. And my favourite place in Cambridge was going around the Botanic Gardens. Plants were my life. And I started a research project into restoration of quarries. It was a bit of a first for Cambridge because I was sponsored by a quarrying company to look at how you could restore habitat once the quarrying company had moved out of the site. So I was working on sheer quarry faces to colonize them with climbing plants.
Yes. I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? We just explore that for a minute because, you know, the Eden Project is situated in a former quarry. You know, where we are here in Wrighton, there's many quarries around here that have been given over to wetlands for the nearby Wildlife Trust to manage. So, I mean, this is an extraordinary thing to turn a bleak site back into some kind of haven for nature. You know, sounds like you were in at the beginning on some of that.
Yes, and it was the time when we were looking at a degraded landscape as a result of the quarry. I actually went back to one of my sites. I used to have a little tiny quarry all to myself, disused, just outside the Bishop's Castle in Shropshire. And I went there about 3 or 4 years ago, and I couldn't actually get into it. It was completely overgrown with trees. I couldn't see my old research site at all because it was just thick with trees, which was brilliant, which is exactly what we wanted. You'd never have known there was a quarry there. And I was a trustee down in Surrey Wildlife Trust for a number of years. We had lots of wonderful chalk quarries, which were home to many, many rare orchids and other species. Very important, intriguing habitats. But my climate change interest goes back to teaching it and also writing children's Key Stage 3 and 4 textbooks where we needed to talk about climate change. And nobody was really talking about it at that time. We'd had the Earth Day summits and things, but nobody was really taking it seriously. We're more worried at that time about ozone layer levels in the Antarctic, and we're worried about acid rain, which we're all talking about in the 90s. But we really didn't talk about global warming as it was then. And so I started writing textbooks for kids and started delving into it at that point. And it's always worried me that nobody was really talking about our own gardens and spaces and green spaces. We were talking on large scale. And so that sort of started triggering lots of ideas in my mind. A very keen photographer at the time, I had an environmental photo library, and I was looking at some terrible things around the world. I mean, I'd go to East Germany and look at acid rain damage to forests there. I've been to the rainforest and seen the deforestation. I'd looked at recycling and sewage outfall points. Great stuff. But that's what I wrote about for 20 years. It was always about what was happening to the environment. And so it was natural for me to really think about my own personal growing spaces and how I could make it more resilient to cope with what I knew was going to come, but to learn. And ecology, botany, whatever, is all about learning. It's observing and trialing and learning from that. So I've always been an experimenter, breaking the rules. But it is interesting because I say this to many people when I do my talks. You know, we are perhaps the first generation of gardeners who can't look back to their grandfathers and ask for advice. Because I know what my grandfather would tell me, and it's totally not applicable to today's style of gardening and conditions. So we are learning on the job. See what works, and everybody will be different because everybody's micro garden and micro habitat in their garden is different to the next. So have to be prepared for success and failures. And this year I've had plenty of failures, courtesy of the slugs. A lot of my drought resilient plants, like my salvia nemorosa, you know, slugs got those this year, not the weather. So it's new. Every year we have failures in the garden, and I have to learn from that.
Yeah. So it sounds to me like your garden is now your very much your research laboratory, if you like. And you've just written the Resilient Garden and Allotment Handbook, which has just come out earlier this year. Tell me a little bit about that book and kind of what led you to feeling like there was a need for a handbook.
I think there was lots of things I wanted to say, discuss, and allow people to learn from my own personal experiences. And it sort of sums up my style of gardening, which is a healthy ecosystem that I'm the keystone species in. I'm the gardener. I'm the one that creates spaces for plants to come in, that prunes them and controls things, but not in a heavy-handed way. And I wanted to talk about biodiversity. And other things as an organic gardener. I'd seen so many brilliant growers doing this, and I wanted to translate that into a concept for gardeners, because some of the organic growers that I've seen have been so inspiring, and I knew that gardeners could learn so much from their experiences. So I've been distilling all that knowledge, which I've been gleaning for the last 10 years in the organic field, and putting that into this book. So the book is looking at soil, of course, and mulching, and looking at pests and that balance between predators and pests. And also, I've been thinking ahead to climate change and what might survive and what might not. And so diversity is so important to me every day. If I have a diverse garden, be it in flowers or insects, then I think I've got a resilient space which can cope with as much as might be thrown at it. Some will fail, some won't, some will survive. And it's distilled down into my vegetable growing. I like not just having one bed, but I do polyculture. There'll be 5-6 different crops in a bed so that pests can't find them. If I grow one bed of brassicas, say, I will grow 5 or 6 different varieties. So again, I've got diversity. And yes, I'm hoping that that diversity will mean resilience. So the book is all about those ideas of bringing diversity into our growing spaces, however small, and to be able to have healthy plants that are able to cope with the stresses that the weather is going to toss at them. And a healthy plant is better positioned to cope with the stress that might be coming.
Well, let's explore that diversity point a bit more. Just imagining that brassica bed with, you know, 7 or 8 different varieties. Just explain why that's important. I can see that within that you might have some that are more successful than others, but actually there's something more important going on, isn't there?
I think for me, with the diversity, particularly in brassicas and things or any species, I don't know what the summer is going to throw at them.
Yeah,
it could be wet, it could be hot. And I'm hoping at the end of the day that one or other of them will survive. It'd be great if they all survived and cropped well. But if we have what we've had for the last few years, that's probably going to be unlikely. Some will love it and thrive, others won't. And I'm basing my ideas on the brilliant population wheat experiment that's been done at Wakelands Agroforestry. And a lot of growers, arable farmers, are now growing this wheat. And the wheat is not a uniform crop. The wheat has been produced from crossing lots and lots of different varieties of wheat to give you a very diverse, genetically diverse, physically diverse crop. So that when an organic, and this is for organics particularly, because we don't rely on fertilizers and pesticides, when you sow this population wheat, it looks very ragged in the field because there's short ones and tall ones and big ears and small ears. But the end of the day, the harvest may not be as big as your typical perfect crop, but something will be harvested. Mm. It's not all going to be wiped out by disease. It won't all succumb to drought. It won't succumb to rust, whatever. You're hedging your bets that
yes,
something in there will survive. And so for me, when I look at modern seeds, I get worried because I know that seed producers are producing seeds for yield and productivity. And I don't want that. I want a resilient plant that has got lots of diversity in its genes and that can cope with all sorts of things. And then I'm going to allow those to cross with each other, which you should never do, and mix it all up. So I get a very heterogenic mixture of genes. So when I plant that next year, I've got a really diverse crop.
You say you should never do it. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's the traditionalist talking. But actually, this is talking about how we can overcome crop failure. So we should all be doing it. We should all be mixing up our seeds.
And this is where Heritage Seed Library comes in, because it's quite important for them to continue to preserve particular lines of crops, so that at some point in the future, I can take those beans or peas or whatever and cross them in my own plot and bring in a new set of genes. Mm. So I love buying lots of different old-fashioned peas. I use my 6 varieties every year to be mostly peas, and I grow them all together. And I'm hoping I'll get a little bit of cross-pollination, which I'll have to do. So I get a very diverse crop, but I need something like the Heritage Seed Library to be able to provide me with those new set of genes that have been protected for a long time and haven't been allowed to cross. So we know we've got that resource that we can use to boost our existing modern crops in a very different way. So I enjoy doing that, and I do it with my parsnips. Every year is my own saved seed with a new variety sown with it that I bought in. And then this time of year, they're all coming back and I allow them to cross-pollinate and save seed. But as an amateur, I don't grow enough, probably. This is my worry. And I'm probably typical of most amateur growers, that I perhaps say parsnip seed from 20 seeds, and it's not enough, but we're all doing this. So that means that the genetic diversity of our own safe seed is getting quite narrow. And that's important that we do a lot of seed swapping.
Yes, absolutely. Local seed swapping as well is critical, isn't it? Because if you're trying to work with the conditions of the area, the soil type of the area, the weather, the, you know, whatever has hit, you know, an area with, I don't know, maybe a 30, 40 mile radius, the seeds are going to be sensitive to that. They will have adapted to that. So local seed swaps are brilliant for viability.
Yes and no. Actually, I think I would like to be swapping seeds with somebody who lives 200 miles south of me.
And bring some of those genes down to you. Because or up to you. Yeah.
My seeds are adapted to what I've got here. Mm. Plants don't adapt quickly. It takes a few generations for them to adapt to an area. So yes, I've got locally adapted seed here, but I want those genes for ability to survive a drought or high ultraviolet intensity, for example, or wet periods, or different pests.
We're in a new era now for pests and diseases, and it's not enough to just say, garden organically, it'll all be okay. So what is your response to that?
Yeah, it is very, very worrying. I think, firstly, diversity will help, because they won't be able to find the plants they like, and mixing them up, polyculture, mixes them all up so they can't find things.
Have you noticed new pests, or, you know, a greater influx of pests in recent years?
Yes and no. I haven't seen any new ones, fortunately. My box plants are still intact. But what I'm seeing is the pattern of when they appear is different. So often I will have a lot of white caterpillars, the large and the white. I'm getting them much earlier and much later than I would normally have expected them. And this is probably because more of our insects are being able to overwinter because of the lack of cold, and they will appear early. And so it is important to sort of stay vigilant. I haven't seen as many aphids this year as I did last, but I know they're going to be there shortly.
Yes.
And there are some new species of Drosophila that I will be looking out for. Lots of my friends on Instagram are worried about the Allium leaf miner and their crops of leeks and onions, which seems to be mostly in the Midlands at the moment. And I've had it 1 year, but it hasn't come back. And perhaps that's an advantage of a walled garden. I'm not quite as exposed, but many of my friends are growing alliums undercover for part of the season when those adult flies are on the wing. I do try things in the orchard. I use pheromones and things to bring them in, particularly some of the moss. But it is vigilance. For me, it's diversity again, not having too many plants the same type in the same place, because that gives out too much messaging, I think, to the pests that they found them. And
it's all about confusing them, isn't it?
Exactly. And I do like to leave the first pests on, particularly cabbage white caterpillars, because the plants talk. So in a bed of cabbage, for example, all of the cabbages are in contact with each other through their root systems and their fungi. And believe it or not, a warning will go up. So the first plant that gets the caterpillar munching on its leaves will actually be able to alert the rest of those plants in that bed that a pest has arrived. And interestingly, plants change their metabolism and they produce more secondary metabolites, which are more protective in nature. It's all this chemical warfare that's going on. Veg beds that nobody knew about. And they will alert other cabbages in that plot that there is a pest around. And those other cabbages will change their metabolism. They'll start producing more chemical defenses. So their leaves are less palatable to the caterpillar. And so the female butterfly will not lay her eggs necessarily on those leaves.
It's incredible. Is that just brassicas?
Probably everything. This is why our fungi are so important, in that we've got this network in the soil and all the plants. It's interesting that they can actually help plants which are not doing so well, in that the fungi will produce more or take more nutrients to the plant that is not surviving as well as the others to bring it along. It's a real nursery system in the bed. So my answer is really, I don't get too excited by the first pest. Just let it sit there, wait for my predatory insects to come along, particularly my parasitic wasps, which I love. Allow the other plants in your bed to defend themselves, to have that messaging. So you've got to let that first few caterpillars get stuck in, and it might benefit the rest of them. Doesn't always work, but you've got to give plants a chance.
Yes, I remember Dave Goulson saying this about blackfly. You know, the first wave, just hold your nerve, because actually it's not just the plants talking to each other, it's also the ladybirds talking to each other. and rather than think, oh no, we've got blackfly, just hold on, because you may lose one or two, but actually the ecosystem will kick in.
Absolutely. And early in the season in my greenhouse, which is one of the most difficult environments to control, saw some early aphids. So I was going around the garden, and the lady who helps me in the garden as well, we were collecting ladybirds and shoving them on my lemon trees. They're all gone. All the ladybirds gone and all the aphids are gone. But with blackfly, my hint is, yes, let the ladybirds come in. They're going to be a week behind at least in terms of populations, because there's always a lag between the predator and the prey. But if you see any ants running up and down, get rid of the ants, because they are protecting the black fly from the ladybirds, because they are milking the black fly for their nectar, their honeydew. The ants run up and down the stem and they find the aphids and they tweak their ends and get that honeydew out of them. And so if you can stop the ants going up the stem of the broad bean, then you will stop the protection. And the easiest way to do that is the little ring of Vaseline at the bottom, and they can't cross the Vaseline. It's a bit like a grease band on a tree, and that stops the protectors of the aphids from getting up to the top of the plant. So then the ladybirds and the predatory insects can come in.
Okay, brilliant advice. I hadn't thought about that. I'd always thought the ants were kind of doing a good job somehow. So I'm glad to be more appraised of the facts. That's brilliant. Thank you. So on to disease as well, this other kind of notion of, you know, that seems kind of in the wake of the pandemic, you know, it just sort of seems like there's we're more alive to it, we're more aware of it, and, you know, and we're hearing about it more, you know, and some of those diseases are, you know, old as the hills, but more prevalent, and some are brand new. What are you observing?
I think for me, again, it's seeing diseases earlier and later. The mildews for me suddenly appear quite early in the season.
Yes, very much so.
Earlier than, you know, especially with this wet weather. Yeah. We're going to see some really weird patterns. And again, it comes back to, you know, hands off. I don't think there's much as an organic gardener I can really do against blight and things. We've always had new varieties of blight comes around the gardening anyway. Every few years, our so-called blight resilient potato varieties are no longer effective, because we've got different varieties of rust and blight rather coming through. So it's changing all the time, and that is going to continue. So again, with my potatoes, you know, I'm hedging my bets. I've got lots of different varieties of potatoes in the hopes that if we do get late blight, I've got something that will survive, particularly the Sapo varieties, which are quite resilient. And yet it comes down to observation. If I do see some fungal disease on my plants, I might whip the leaf off. I have tried sort of spraying them with foliar sprays and things, which people do say can have some influence on encouraging the beneficials and detracting from the pathogenic fungal spores. But it's quite tricky because I think once you spot the disease, the fungus is there and the fungal spores are all around us. So it's one of those things I'm sort of beginning to have to learn to live with. Black spot on my roses, I sort of shrug my shoulders and go, okay.
What about the cold? I mean, we haven't had extreme cold for a long time and we're not sure what's going to happen in that regard. So what's your view around working with a lack of cold?
Yeah, and equally worrying and to fruit growers, most worrying aspect of climate change perhaps is that most of our fruit trees and many of our trees and shrubs require a certain number of hours of chill a winter. So that's a period of time normally between 7 degrees and 1 degree temperature, sort of nice, chilly, not quite frosty, but nice, chilly weather, which we normally associate with December and January and February. And that those chill hours accumulate and so that the plant knows when it's safe to open its buds in spring. Because if it hasn't accumulated enough chill, then it thinks it's too early in the season for it to open its buds and its protective mechanism. Which is interesting why when we grow apricots and peaches, they flower in February because they have no chill requirement. So now, this year particularly, we didn't have much chill. I think somebody was telling me they were 300 hours under the target and most trees need about 1,000 hours and they were only getting 600 or 700 hours, which means that when they come to flowering, it's a little bit haphazard because they're never quite sure when to flower. So orchards this year were a bit variable. And interestingly, I have six Beauty of Bath trees and I would have expected them all to flower at the same time and they weren't. So something's gone wrong. They haven't had enough chill and that leads to inadequate pollination sometimes, particularly those that require cross pollinators. And that may lead this year to a poor crop. I'm interested to see how that develops, but this is going to be an issue. So as I look forward to what I might be growing and replacing trees, I'm increasingly looking for fruit varieties which have a low chill requirement. Something like a Bramley is okay, a Spartan is okay. And if you have to really interrogate the fruit tree producers about which varieties would suit. Now, you're okay up in Worcester because you could grow varieties from Devon or Cornwall. If you're in Scotland, you could look to Worcester. Yeah. But for me down in Somerset, I'm probably wiser to look to the Channel and beyond to think about what grows in Normandy and to look for French varieties which have a lower chill requirement. So this is me looking 10, 15 years hence because I'm hoping my apple trees will start fruiting in 6 to 8 years and have max crop for 20 odd years. So 2040, I don't know what they're going to be growing in. So I want something that grows perhaps from Normandy or Brittany that hasn't got the chill. And then I think we also need to look at rootstocks. We've been using the Malin rootstocks for donkey's years, back from the 50s. They were designed for a different world and we're still using those fruit stocks on our fruit trees. So I do think we need to be a little bit more exploratory and think about perhaps rootstocks from Eastern Europe. And I know some of the more forward-thinking fruit tree producers are looking at this very issue, or maybe using an American rootstock, that will give them more resilience to climate. Don't know, but that's what I would be looking for.
So the world is changing, climate is changing, we're having to adapt. We want our gardens to be part of the solution. I'm really interested to know, in this journey, what has been the biggest challenge for you that you've found ways to overcome?
For me, I think it is the flip-flop nature of this climate, in that I've no sooner got my head around coping with drought than we then enter an era of cold, wet, warm weather, and I have to rethink. And then it's interesting talking to Andy Dibben at Abbey Home Farm near Cirencester. He said he's just gone through perhaps what he would consider 18 months, the most difficult 18 months of his growing career. And for me, I think it's you overcome these difficulties through the experimenting. It comes back to that word again, diversity, having lots of different types of plants, watching, learning, experimenting with things, and being prepared for failure. We are all going to have failures in our gardens, but there will be something else that will do well in its place. So what I've learned is, if I can't grow a plant in the place, I'm obviously growing it in the wrong place. And it is back to that old adage of right place, right plant. And so I'm far more observant of how they behave. And if it's not working, get rid of it and try something else, because there will be another plant out there that will do well in that place. And you just need to give it a try, and just be prepared for setbacks. And the garden might look terrible at certain times of the year when we're in the middle of a drought, but it will, you know, plants are incredibly resilient things and they will bounce back. You'll lose some, but you won't lose everything. I mean, this winter, I lost lots of things, like everybody. I lost my dahlias. They got through, but the slugs got them as they were coming through. I was quite relieved, though, to see that despite a wet, warm winter, my cannas and my gingers have bounced back. And I would have laid money that they wouldn't make it with these wet conditions, which they really hate. So, yeah, they're coping. So give them a try. Try different plants perhaps you haven't tried before. Put them in a different place. But it's observation, experimentation, and prepared to fail, but to know that the next plant that you grow might be successful and give you much pleasure.
Time now for the postbag, where we answer your questions. We've got two really good ones this month. I'm here with Anton and Chris. Hello.
Hi, Fiona.
Hi.
So we're going straight in on tomatoes. Now, that's a big topic in this organisation. We talk about tomatoes a lot because, of course, the Heritage Seed Library holds so many varieties of tomatoes. We all absolutely love them. But David has had an issue. He says, please, can you tell me why several of my tomatoes are hard and yellow at the top? So that's quite an interesting dilemma. What do you reckon, Anton?
So this is a bit of a physiological thing. I must admit, it's not something I come across that often, but often it's just the conditions under which the tomatoes are grown. If it's really too hot for them, they tend to develop that sort of corky growth on the top of the tomato. So if you're growing them in a greenhouse, you want to make sure it's well ventilated. Make sure you open the doors during the day. It's quite difficult this time of year as well, when if it can be cold at night and then it gets really hot during the day. So you need to be sort of opening and closing the doors a bit more. Also, the plants don't like the sort of direct sunlight on them. We sort of assume that tomatoes really like a lot of sun, but they actually quite like diffuse light. So,
okay.
I mean, in the past, they used to even paint special white paint onto the side of glass houses.
Yeah.
But a sort of makeshift solution at home is, if you've got a south-facing part of your greenhouse, then I've just hung some fleece on there. I know we're not meant to be using fleece outside because it all sort of breaks down and shreds everywhere. But if you hang it in your greenhouse, we've had it, it's lasted at least sort of 6 or 7 years. So it's, you know, it lasts quite a while, and that just diffuses the light coming onto it.
You could use other things. You could use net curtains, for example, or
you could
if it needs to be sort of semi-permeable,
exactly, that something diffuses the light.
Right. Is there any kind of lack of nutrient that might be causing the discoloration?
So it could be something like lack of potash can cause that as well. Tomatoes need quite a lot of potassium because they're a fruiting crop, and you might see that there's other signs of lack of potash. It begins with a sort of yellowing of the margins of the leaves, and then if it gets really serious, you sort of see brown patches on the leaves as well. So a good feed of comfrey would help that. We've also more recently discovered that nettle feed also has good levels of potash.
I was just thinking when Anton said that, I've been doing this 4 years and I've learned something there. You know, obviously the work we do here is to look into this stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
This stuff out, because you'd always assume nettles nitrogen. So that's an important bit of information, I'd say.
Yeah. Tell us more. How did you discover that?
Well, we've often seen on the internet, nettle's got a lot of nitrogen and comfrey's got a lot of potash in. But I'd never actually seen a study that compared the two grown at the same place. So we actually got members to send in samples of liquids they made of nettles and comfrey growing in the same garden, and we've compared them. We found a lot of variability between the gardens, but actually we found that nettles had a significant amount of potassium in there. Comfrey, a little bit more, but definitely if you've only got a patch of nettles in your garden, that would still make a pretty good tomato feed.
Okay. That's great, isn't
it? That's good, good information.
I mean, of course, this time of year, people are thinking, well, I've got all those green tomatoes. How am I going to ripen them up? What do you do about that, Chris?
Yeah, it has been the year of the green tomato, hasn't it? Literally, the first thing I do is I'd leave them on the plant as long as possible, because you can almost, like, you get a hot day, a warmish day, which you can in October, early October, you get a warmish day. They still might ripen up on the plant. I'm sure in September when I was correcting them, they were ripening on the same day as I was picking them, you know. So give it a bit of time. If not, I literally put them in either two things. I put them in a cardboard box with a few ripe ones, and I'd make sure you turn them so you don't get mould or get stodgy. Or the old trick I've said before, tea towel in a drawer, you know, and just roll them in there. Make sure you turn them regularly and they'll ripen up for you, no problem. It's not the end of the tomatoes because they're green. And if all else fails, nice bolognese sauce for green tomatoes, no problem at all.
Yeah, I mean, they don't do you any harm, green tomatoes, do they?
No, and I'm not. You know, if you've gone to all the trouble to grow them, you don't want to waste them.
No.
You could do a relish. There's, you know, if nothing goes to waste, nothing.
And if you have still got some green tomatoes and you've not yet had a frost, then would you just leave them and hope for the best? What would you do, Anton?
Yeah, leave them on the plant as long as possible. Just keep an eye on the weather because you don't want to leave them outside on a frosty day.
Yeah, okay. All right, so keep it going as long as you can. We love the tomato season. Okay, a big question now all around collecting leaves. Let me read you the question, but this is a lot to dive into. So the question is, what are your views on collecting leaves from the roadside to use to create compost and or leaf mould? A simple question on the face of it, but actually quite complex. So first of all, Anton, what's the position around collecting leaves from the roadside? The legal position?
The legal position, well, technically, those leaves belong to whoever's land it is. It could be sort of legally stealing those leaves from the person. I don't know how much that would really be enforced.
It
puts a whole new meaning to the word tea leaf, doesn't it?
But there are probably lots of other concerns about taking leaves from close to the road.
Okay, so we're less concerned about legal position, which is that leaves belong to the landowner. But assuming you know the landowner or you're not worried about that, what are going to be the pitfalls of those particular leaves?
So particularly if they've fallen on the floor, there's a lot of things emitted by traffic. They've taken the lead out of petrol a long time ago.
But
there's still a lot of other nasty things coming out of traffic. Tire dust is a particularly bad one that just gets scattered around, particularly locally to the roadside. Also brake linings and things. There's all sorts of heavy metals, and heavy metals just don't go away. They don't get broken down in compost, so you don't want to be adding them to your compost. As to sort of what distance is a safe distance, there's lots of work that's been done on it, but it just depends on which study you read, really. There's a lot, you know, some say that it takes 10 metres for it to sort of dissipate. Others say there's still stuff within as far away as 40 metres. So, you know, it's not a simple answer.
So if you live in a town, as I do, and you've got leaves falling in your garden from the trees in your garden, as long as there's a hedgerow between you and the road, then the hedgerow will bear the brunt of that pollution generally.
Yeah, so hedges are very good at screening from the pollution. So it means that all the sort of dust and stuff won't be falling onto the leaves that you're then adding to your compost. So yeah, certainly the hedgerow will act as a screen to sort of reduce that amount of sort of dust pollution onto those leaves.
Right, okay. But generally speaking, if you see a bunch of very lovely looking leaves on a verge, the advice is to leave well alone.
Yeah, I would leave them, and basically the plants will gradually take up those nutrients, but we're not going to be eating those plants. I mean, unfortunately, pollution is everywhere. We'll just try and sort of minimise the impacts of it.
And, I mean, that does beg the question, if a whole load of leaves blow into your garden and, you know, land on flower beds, land on vegetable patches, what would be your advice then? Would you just leave them, or what would you do?
I mean, I'd hope if you've got a front garden by a road, you probably wouldn't be growing vegetables. But so I wouldn't be so bothered about on your sort of non-edible things.
Yeah,
I might be more concerned about things I was going to eat, certainly. I mean, they tend to advise any sort of veg that you wash it really well, that the main thing is actually the soil on those vegetables rather than the amount that they've taken up. That's like the amount that's in the soil is going to be a lot more than any sort of amounts that the plants have taken up.
Okay. All right. So a bit of vigilance required. Let's back up a minute and just talk about leaf mould in general, because it's exactly the right time of year to be talking about it. So, Chris, what is it?
I think a great way to look at it is you have this massive free bonanza of soil improver fall out of the sky in every orm.
Yeah.
And in the past, we've just dug holes and dumped them in landfills, and that just couldn't be more ridiculous for it.
Yeah.
Throwing away a valuable, valuable asset. For me, it's a soil improver, first and foremost. If you're in a forest, leaves fall, they rot down, they keep the soil nice and drainage-wise and penetrable by roots. So it's just that cycle. They're good for conditioning the soil. They're quite slow to break down. Leaf mould's quite slow to break down. Some leaves, like an oak, can take a long, long time. So I used to accelerate it. I put grass cuttings in with it, mix it together. You could do two things. You can add them to your compost because it's a brown at the end of the day to mix with your greens and that break down in there. Well, the other thing is quite a nice idea is just put a little leaf mould bay at the back of a border. So you want, you know, four bits of wood, stakes or four bits of bamboo. Buy yourself a roll of chicken wire. Loop that round the woods and then just put your leaves in there. Turn it sometimes if you want to speed it up, or just let it naturally break down. And I would apply it as a mulch. It's great, great stuff. I watched the Westminster Abbey. I watched it where the soil was just dust. We took out a lot of Prunus laurus serris, the big laurel, and all the nutrient had gone out of the soil. And it was like dust. Not even chickweed would grow in it. And in one season, literally, we added all this leaf mould in, which is broken down with grass clippings, and it just improved the soil no end.
Wow.
It really does work quite quickly. As for timings, I prefer to apply a mulch in late winter, early spring, as the soil starts to warm and the worms will pull in. But you might want to add it in the autumn as well, just to protect the soil. Almost like a green manure.
It takes quite a long time to make it, doesn't it? Let's just go back to basics a bit on that then. So you've got your chicken wire cage. You've lobbed the leaves in, maybe you've added some grass clippings. How long is that going to take before that turns into leaf mould?
Well, I reckon a couple of seasons, really. It's not that's why it's such good gear, because it breaks down and it's so, you know, it really does turn into something golden. You can accelerate it with grass clippings. I have done that, and they keep it irrigated. So it's almost like composting, but you're using just two materials.
Yeah.
Using the green and you're using the brown, and you're keeping the moisture in it, and you're turning it to get all the activity going to break it down quicker. But if you're not in a hurry, then you could just let it nature do its toll. We've said before, I think compost that I've cold composted tend to be much finer and nicer to use than ones that have been hot composted. I think nature does it itself. You probably get a better product, but that's doubting. Have you got the space to consume it? One little idea we've done quite a bit of this, is if you're there's a local park, you find a lot of volunteers when local parks, see if you can get them to set up a big leaf mould bay in your park, and then everybody can come along and use it.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
That's maybe something you can do. That's quite possible. And then you've got, obviously, in a park, you've got lots of trees.
Lovely idea.
Then everybody's got access to it, you know.
Yeah.
So that's just maybe a food for thought.
Very good. Well, thank you very much. Lots of learnings there, definitely, for me anyway. Thanks. See you next time. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's all we've got time for this month. On the next podcast, I'll be visiting Orsa Gregers Warg, head gardener at the fabulous Beth Chatto Gardens. Do send us in your organic gardening questions. You can contact us via our website or social media. We're at Garden Organic UK on Facebook, Twitter, TikTok and LinkedIn. And if you're not a member of Garden Organic already, now's a great time to join. Thanks again to our sponsors, Viridian Nutrition, and to Kevin McLeod for the music. That's it. Until next time.